Dior always ended his shows with a wedding dress. And I never really understood what the emotional impact of that might be until I started to watch the film in the editing room, because this whole adventure with the dress is an opportunity for Ada to open her heart again, having lost her husband and essentially put her heart on ice. It's almost like permission to feel again. And I find that moment very, very moving.
On today's episode of Shelf Life, we go to sea with a pair of cats in Paul Gallico's classic children's novel, Jenny, also known as The Abandoned in the US. We put on our dancing shoes for Colin McCann's mesmerizing 2003 novel of Rudolf Nureyev, Dancer. And we go to Paris with Mrs. Harris, courtesy of my guest, the director and screenwriter, Anthony Fabian. That's coming up on Shelf Life. Stay with us.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Amy Held. The Department of Homeland Security says it's taking emergency measures to limit costs 9 days after Congress failed to fund it. NPR's Luke Garrett reports travelers may be starting to feel the impact of this partial government shutdown at U.S. airports.
DHS is directing the Transportation Security Administration to end pre-check lanes during the shutdown, but a TSA spokesperson says pre-check remains open and operational, and they will evaluate service on a, quote, case-by-case basis. DHS Secretary Kristi Noem blamed congressional Democrats for the travel impacts. In a statement, Noem said DHS is working to, quote, mitigate the damage inflicted by these politicians. DHS is also suspending all non-disaster-related FEMA funding. This comes as a significant winter storm bears down on the Northeast. The White House and top congressional Democrats have yet to agree on a path forward on DHS funding following the killings of two U.S. citizens at the hands of federal agents. Luke Garrett, NPR News, Washington.
The Secret Service says agents shot dead a man in his early 20s who breached the secure perimeter at Mar-a-Lago early this morning. Authorities say the man was observed carrying, quote, a shotgun and a fuel can before he was confronted. Rafael Barros is with the Secret Service.
Only words that we said to him was drop the items, which means the gas can and the shotgun. He put the gas can down and pointed the shotgun at the officers.
President Trump was in Washington, not at his Florida residence at the time. At least one person was killed and 25 wounded in what authorities are calling a terrorist attack in western Ukraine. NPR's Polina Litvinova reports from Kyiv at the same time Russian drones and missiles were striking other parts of Ukraine.
President Volodymyr Zelensky reported on social media that the police have already arrested several suspects who may be involved in the attack. According to law enforcement agencies, after midnight, police received a call about a burglary at a store in the Lviv city center. When the patrols arrived at the scene, two explosions occurred. A 23-year-old female police officer was killed in the attack. Meanwhile, according to Zelensky, last night Russia launched about 50 missiles and almost 300 drones on Ukraine, targeting energy, water supply, and railway facilities. Polina Litvinova, NPR News, Kyiv.
Denmark's military says its Arctic Command forces evacuated a crew member of a U.S. submarine for urgent medical treatment. It happened off the coast of Greenland yesterday. Earlier, President Trump had said he was planning to assist Greenland with its health care, sending a, quote, great hospital boat to the Arctic island and semi-autonomous territory of Denmark, one Trump has long sought to acquire. Today, Denmark's defense minister rejected that plan. You're listening to NPR News. A rare win for the U.S. in the final event of the Winter Olympics. Steve Futterman reports from Milan.
For the first time in 46 years, the U.S. wins gold at the Winter Olympics in men's hockey. It was a thrilling game between these two great rivals, the U.S. and Canada. The U.S. took a 1-0 lead in the first period. Canada tied the game 1-1 in the second. Neither team could score in the third. Then it went to overtime, and just 1 minute, 41 seconds into the overtime, Jack Hughes had an open net from the left side. He put it in, and a celebration began on the ice. The last time the U.S. won gold in men's hockey at the Olympics was 1980. That was the year of the miracle on ice. For NPR News, I'm Steve Futterman in Milan.
An artifact from the Battle of the Alamo is being restored. Texas Public Radio's Jerry Clayton reports from San Antonio.
The cannon was originally discovered in 1852 near the site of the Alamo. The owner, Samuel Maverick, was a signer of the Texas Declaration of Independence. Colby Lanham is senior researcher and historian for the Alamo.
I was kind of skeptical, if I'm being honest.
The man offering to donate the artifact was a direct descendant of Maverick.
Yeah, I about fell over. I think he could have knocked me over with a feather. I was so excited. And I had wrote about that cannon in my master's thesis.
The cannon was located on a ranch near Corpus Christi and was previously at another ranch near San Antonio, where it was used as the base of a bird bath. The 3-foot-long, 90-pound cannon is being restored at Texas A&M University. I'm Jerry Clayton in San Antonio.
This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org. And Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts.
Dior always ended his shows with a wedding dress, and I never really understood what the emotional impact of that might be until I started to watch the film in the editing room, because this whole adventure with the dress is an opportunity for Ada to open her heart again, having lost her husband and essentially put her heart on ice. It's almost like permission to feel again. And I find that moment very, very moving.
Hello and welcome to Shelf Life. I'm Aaron Hicklin.
Hello. Summer at the movies usually means superhero epics or animated family blockbusters. But this summer is not like other summers, because this summer we have Mrs. Harris Goes to Paris, a big-hearted, bittersweet rom-com about dreamers, misfits, and the world's most fabulous frocks, based on a novel by Paul Gallico and written and directed by Anthony Fabian. Fabian is a longtime Gallico fan, and for this episode of Shelf Life, he has chosen the author's beloved children's book, Jenny, also known as The Abandoned in the US, about a boy's metamorphosis into a cat, one of his two favourite books. The other is Dancer, the 2003 novel by the Irish writer Colm McCann, about the life of the legendary dancer Rudolf Nureyev. Born in San Francisco, Fabian grew up in Mexico, Paris, and London, and studied film at UCLA before making his debut with Skin, about a black woman born to white racist parents in South Africa. The movie was a People's Choice Award finalist at the 2008 Toronto Film Festival and went on to win 22 international awards. Asked by one interviewer for his advice to emerging filmmakers, he replied, "Persevere, persevere, persevere. To put it another way, never give up." Anthony Fabian, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Lovely to be here.
Let's talk about perseverance. It took 10 years to bring Mrs. Harris Goes to Paris to the screen. There must have been times when you felt it wouldn't happen. What made you persevere with it?
You're absolutely right. In fact, I remember waking up about a year before we started pre-production and thinking, really, I should give this all up and go to Italy and raise sheep. This is all too hard. But that's not really my style. So the next day I got myself up and kept going. What made it so hard was really the casting, actually, because Mrs. Harris is what you'd traditionally cast as a character actress, but we needed a leading lady to encourage the finance to make the film. And character actresses who are leading ladies are few and far between. Particularly with my quest for authenticity, I really couldn't go down the route of Julia Roberts or somebody like that. It had to be a British actress. She had to be age appropriate. That really limited the field a lot. So that, I think that was one of the biggest challenges of getting this film made, in fact.
Much as I love Julia Roberts, I can't imagine anyone else but Leslie Manville in the role. We should explain the broad plot of the story. Mrs. Harris, wonderfully played by Leslie Manville, is a house cleaner in 1950s London who's inspired by a Christian Dior dress she spies in a customer's closet to raise the funds, involving various shenanigans, to fly to Paris to buy a Christian Dior dress of her own. And although initially shunned by the Parisian fashionistas, she ultimately triumphs in the process, helping drag couture into the 20th century of ready-to-wear. When did you know you wanted to make this film?
I, as you mentioned earlier, have been a lifelong Paul Gallico fan. It started with Jenny, which we're going to talk about a bit later. And I read many of his books, but strangely enough, I didn't come across the Mrs. Harris books until many years later. I signed with a manager in LA who also represents the Paul Gallico estate. And he sent me a script of Mrs. Harris, which at that time was had been developed by another producer. And they were just looking for a director and somebody who could help them with this conundrum of casting, which, you know, plagues everyone trying to make this particular story. And I immediately fell in love with this character. I thought she was absolutely delightful. And the other factor that really made it compelling for me was that my father moved to Paris when I was seven. And Paris is a second home for me. I speak fluent French, and yet I've spent most of my life in England and the majority of that time in London. So I felt that a story that was set in London and Paris was one that I could really do justice to and tell in an authentic way. And too often I've seen films about France and the French made by British people, which I find embarrassing and cliched and somehow chocolate boxy. And I wanted to avoid all of that. So I thought really I was the man for the job.
I mean, you really do avoid that. I think rather cleverly, the movie has some sort of keen-eyed social activism. You know, Mrs. Harris arrives in Paris to find the streets strewn with trash thanks to a strike. And in a very critical moment, she instigates a strike herself. The few sort of irremediably snooty characters get a well-deserved comeuppance. The film really gives a sort of contemporary consciousness, particularly in relation to class. Was that in the original book by Paul Gallico? Was that something you added?
No, it wasn't in the Gallico. And I thought it was really essential to try to make it feel like a contemporary story, whilst at the same time remaining true to its period. And I considered at one stage whether it might be possible to update it to the present time, but that really didn't work at all because the world of fashion has changed completely since the 1950s. And for a start, while Dior is still a big brand, it's not the leading sole brand in the way that in the 1950s, Dior was really king of the fashion world. He'd created this trend called the new look, and he set the fashion world alight with this. So it was very important that it remain in the 50s because Dior was so important then, but also because you can get pretty much anything you want anywhere you like. You don't have to get on a plane or a boat to go to Paris to buy something French in London now. You can just buy it from the shop locally. So everything's become very international in a way that it wasn't in the 1950s. It was clear that I wanted to keep it within its period, but I also wanted it to resonate for contemporary audiences. So bringing in things like the strikes and the workers' rights elements, I thought was going to be helpful to add another layer. But what I discovered in adapting this particular novella was that some of the elements that we brought in to it actually appear in the later Mrs. Harris books. So in the second book, Mrs. Harris goes to New York. He introduces a character who is called Mr. Bayswater, who is in a way the prototype for our Archie, who doesn't exist in the first book. But he obviously felt the need to create a love interest for Ada Harris later on. And we felt the need to create him in the first book. So we brought him in earlier. And then in Mrs. Harris, Member of Parliament, the workers' rights aspect of her character really comes to the fore. So although we in a way, invented these things for the first book. They are contained within the later books.
This show, of course, is about books. I wonder if you can tell me a little about the challenge of adapting a novel like this for the screen.
The biggest challenge of adapting Paul Gallico is that he's too nice to his characters and he solves problems for them far too quickly. What we need for drama is something with higher stakes and more obstacles. So that was the biggest challenge for the adaptation, was creating obstacles for Ada that were both credible but wouldn't upset people who were passionate about the original. And so we had to remain true to the original but create new scenarios, new obstacles in her path that would help to increase the tension and drama in the story.
You're listening to Shelf Life. I'm Aaron Hicklin, and I'm talking to the film director and writer, Anthony Fabian, most recently of the film Mrs. Harris Goes to Paris. You, of course, brought the H back to Mrs. Harris in the original. It's Mrs. Harris. There's a little bit of Dick Van Dyke going on in the original book. I mean, he's not amazing with dialogue. You had the sort of challenge of having to take that dialogue and make it feel real and relevant.
Gallico's dialogue is appalling on the whole, and it's very patronizing. I think leaving the H off Mrs. Harris is patronizing as well. And even if that's how she pronounces it, I would never write that down myself. But weirdly, we were able still to use some of the dialogue from the book. We just had to be very, very careful about what stayed and what didn't, and to not create a kind of mockney in the dialogue. We also introduced a new element, which I think, again, added to the sense of it feeling more contemporary and more relevant to today, which is that her best friend, rather than being a fellow Cockney, is a Jamaican. And Archie, this new character we created, again, isn't a Cockney, he's Northern Irish. So that gave different flavors to the dialogue and to the accents, which I think helped take it away from a kind of Benny Hill or Mockney world.
Yeah, the Benny Hill version of Mrs. Harris, I don't think I need to ever see. The movie also very cleverly shows that all of these sort of big cheeses at the House of Dior, with maybe the exception of Mr. Dior himself, are kind of living a double life in a sense. At work, they're immaculately put together, fully in charge. But when we see them at home, we get a very different perception, smaller in many ways, which makes them all incredibly human. So Mrs. Colbert, played by Isabel Huppert, rather wonderfully, turns out to be living in this pretty humble home. She has to take care of her husband who was injured during the Second World War. The contrast between the theater of fashion and the kind of backstage world of real people is ever present in this movie. And I wondered how critical that was to your vision of this film.
You're absolutely right that this sort of double life idea is very key to the adaptation, because Ada Harris herself is a very authentic character who is not wearing a mask and is not pretending to be anyone else. And one of her magical effects, if you like, on other people is that she unmasks them, she reveals them, she makes them more authentic through her own authentic self and behavior. And it was therefore necessary to create characters who were all in some way not fully fulfilled until she arrives and helps them find themselves. That is in part inspired by the Gallico, but it was certainly accentuated by us.
You started your career, essentially, I understand, at the age of 7 in a bank commercial that featured your mother. Were you clear very early on that this was a path you wanted to follow?
I'm very impressed by your research. But yes, I think, well, apart from a very brief stint just before the bank commercial of thinking I wanted to be a vet because I loved animals, I did have that moment, you know, being on a set for the first time, I felt really at home and I felt that I'd found the world that I wanted to continue to inhabit for the rest of my life. And indeed, that's what I've done. But having started as an actor, I then became frustrated by the process of how you get work auditions and having to consider material that you didn't necessarily respond to. So I became interested in writing and from writing to directing. And I went after film school into theater and in particular opera for a period of years in order to get more physical directing experience because filmmaking was very, very expensive at the time. You couldn't make a film with an iPhone at that time. But then I came back to my first love, which is filmmaking.
Anthony, you mentioned that there was a period in your life when you wanted to become a vet. I feel that's a very good segue into the first book we're going to talk about today, which is Jenny by Paul Gallico. We've mentioned it already a few times. I also read this when I was a child. This is a book about a young boy who was knocked down by a coal truck and awakes to find that he's metamorphosed into a cat. But it's really his friendship with another cat, a part Scottish tabby called Jenny, that forms the basis of this book, as he learns from her how to live as a cat and navigates, among other things, a sea voyage with a motley crew of sailors, really the great set piece of the novel. The books we read in childhood often resonate through our lives. I wonder why this is the book that has resonated for you.
The book has many themes, and in particular, it explores the theme of abandonment. So the book was called Jenny or The Abandoned. I think The Abandoned isn't a great title, but it does at least express the theme of abandonment. And along with that sense of abandonment, it explores the theme of trust, because this little boy, Peter, at the heart of the story, he's been somewhat abandoned by his parents, who are too busy to care for him. And they seem to be arguing and not happy, potentially going to split up. And I think that fear of abandonment is very strong in children. Certainly, my parents were divorced. I was sent to boarding school. I read this book in boarding school. So if I need to explain the psychology any further of how abandoned an 11-year-old in boarding school might feel, you know, perhaps the listeners might be able to join the dots there. So that was certainly a factor in terms of what drew me to this book. But as I say, it's also about trust, because during the course of the novel, Jenny, who's also been abandoned by the little girl who was supposed to be her carer and therefore hates adults, learns through her growing love for Peter to begin to trust human beings again. And that's a very beautiful arc that she goes through in the book. It's a coming-of-age story as well for him. So he starts off very much as an immature little boy cat who doesn't know how to be a cat. And through her, she initially is a sort of mother figure, but then she almost becomes a kind of girlfriend figure as the story progresses. And he does grow physically and emotionally into a mature cat who then has to fight a very dangerous tomcat to the death in order to protect Jenny. And that's quite an extraordinary arc and journey that he goes on as well. And I think, you know, as a little boy going through that puberty and process of metamorphosing from a boy into a man, I think that also resonated for me.
I'm Aaron Hicklin, and you're listening to Shelf Life. My guest on this episode is the director, Anthony Fabian. I want to talk more about the book, but I'm struck by this image of the young Tony Fabian reading Jenny at boarding school. I wonder if you could draw a picture of this boarding school for us.
Oh, I'm really ashamed to say that. It was a very beautiful Jacobean manor house in the middle of the Cotswolds. And it was a house that had belonged to David Niven's family. So he had grown up there. That was the romance that attracted me to this boarding school, already smitten with the idea of being a filmmaker. But it was actually a very grim place, because there were 100 boys, no girls. They were introduced a bit later. And it was very cold. It was always gray. It seemed to be permanently raining or frost on the grass in the winter months. And having grown up in Mexico and not experienced winter before, that was a bit of a shock. The fact that you could put a glass of water next to your bed in the morning, it would be frozen. gives you some idea of the Dickensian atmosphere of this place. And there were rules everywhere, rules that made absolutely no sense, but you had to follow and obey. For example, you couldn't wear long trousers unless you were 5'2" or 12 years old. I mean, why? You couldn't talk if there was food in front of you. So a natural activity during a meal is to converse with your fellow diners, but you weren't allowed to do that. You weren't allowed to talk in certain rooms. You weren't allowed to enter this bit of the woods that was out of bounds. So all of these rules, which I think were meant to train you in some kind of military fashion into being law-abiding, just made me more rebellious and utterly hate a rule-bound system.
One of the things that's actually very entertaining about Jenny is the way in which the sort of class structures of society are slightly replicated in the world of cats. So Jenny spends a lot of time talking about her ancestry back to Abyssinia and beyond that to ancient Egypt, and has very little good to say about a Maltese cat that she meets in Glasgow. I think the quote is something like, she's not even Scottish, she's Italian. I mean, it's very tongue-in-cheek, but I really liked the way he kind of took the sort of class strictures of British life and injected them into the story of two cats and their world.
Yeah, and you know that Gallico was originally American, but moved to the UK and lived most of his adult life in the UK. So very similar to me in that way. And also lived with 23 cats. So he knew a lot about cat behavior. So he was very, very knowledgeable about cats. But he did observe the class system and, as you say, imbued Jenny with it, but also Mrs. Harris. And one of the things that appealed to me about Mrs. Harris was that she leaves her very strict position in society when she leaves the UK and goes to France and can make new rules in a way. And that's one of the joys of travel, is that you can reinvent yourself and not be judged by the same rules and by the same strata in society.
Tony, back to cats. One of the absolute pleasures of reading Jenny is the way that it appeals to this desire, I think particularly strong and present in children, to imagine themselves in other bodies. And I have a very, very distinct memory of tucking a scarf into the top of my trousers so that it resembled a tail and walking around after my cat, Scamp, to see if I could persuade him that I too was a cat. And at least on one occasion, I put down a saucer of milk next to Scamp's saucer of milk and crouched there, lapping it up, just to see if I could persuade my cat that I was also a cat.
Did it work?
I don't think it worked. I think my cat looked at me very strangely. Okay. And just carried on doing what cats do, which is ignoring humans most of the time. But there is a scene in this book where Peter has to learn to lap up milk and makes a complete mess of it at first, and then is taught by Jenny to curl his tongue under rather than out, which is the way a human would do it. Cats, of course, have very flexible tongues.
I have to confess, I had dogs in my childhood, but I always loved cats. What Gallico gives you is a kind of National Geographic perfect view of what it is to be a cat, which is so irresistible. And you do learn an enormous amount about cat psychology and cat behavior, which I've carried with me ever since.
There's a very moving scene on the boat. So Jenny and Peter hitch a ride, essentially, on a tug that's going to Glasgow, where Jenny wants to ostensibly track down her family. And Jenny, at one point, is swept overboard. As a book, it feels to me, for young children, quite daring in that it does deal with life and death. I wouldn't describe the ending as a happy ending. It's a poignant ending. How did you handle that as a child?
I suppose I've always been attracted to powerful emotions. So it didn't upset me. Of course, it upset me in the sense that, like you, I also cried reading the book. And I think one of the wonderful things about this book or any children's book that's becomes a classic or is worth rereading as an adult is that there are adult themes and things that we can all relate to. And certainly the themes of abandonment, of trust, of life and death, these are very big themes, and I think he doesn't shy away from them. So having said that he's too kind to his characters for the cinema, he certainly doesn't pull his punches in this book when it comes to big moments. There are, you know, as you know, there's a moment when she trains Peter. They, on the ship, they have to earn their keep by keeping down the mouse and rat population. And she has to teach him how to kill a rat, which is not easy and extremely dangerous. And of course, that plants the seed for how he will have his ultimate fight in the book. These are powerful scenes and, as you say, quite frightening, I think, for a child. But as with all the best Disney movies, I think its strength is always based on how far it's willing to go, how dangerous it's willing to be. And I think he manages that tightrope extremely well.
Were you a big reader as a child, Tony?
Yes, I've never really not been with a book that's on the go. So yes, I've always loved disappearing into a book, and particularly being in boarding school and feeling the need to escape my immediate reality. Books provided a great outlet for that.
Would you say you were a lonely child?
I think I wasn't really very present when I was a child. I didn't enjoy being a child. I spent much of my childhood imagining what life would be like once I stopped being a child, once I were a grown-up. And I am perhaps one of those strange people who did actually find happiness once I was no longer at school, no longer oppressed by all of these rules and having to follow this kind of routine. Strangely enough, I found university extremely liberating because there wasn't the same degree of oppressive regulation about it. And with one exception, I've never been employed by anybody. I find it quite difficult to have a rule structure around me.
I think the rest of the world is fast catching up with you. You're listening to Shelf Life with me, Aaron Hicklin. My guest is the director, Anthony Fabian. We've been talking about Jenny by Paul Gallico. More book talk after this.
One of Japan's most famous writers, Haruki Murakami, gets compared to American giants like Raymond Chandler and Kurt Vonnegut. But of course, his voice is all his own. This week on Selected Shorts, we delve into Murakami then and now. Join me, Meg Wolitzer.
Selected Shorts, Sunday night at 7 on Radio Catskill.
This is Radio Catskill. There's a winter storm warning for our listening area from 1 this afternoon through 7 tomorrow evening. Heavy snow will start moving into our area late this afternoon. 8 to 16 inches is possible, more in high elevations in areas to the east, less in Delaware and northern Wayne counties. New York State's declared a state of emergency in Sullivan, Ulster, and Orange counties, among others. State officials urge residents to stay home throughout the duration of the storm. This is Radio Catskill.
Hello, you're listening to Shelf Life. I'm Aaron Hicklin, and I'm talking to Anthony Fabian about Dancer by the Irish writer Colm McCann. Tony, my mother is a huge ballet fan and a massive fan of Margot Fonteyn and Nureyev. But I came to this book, Dancer by Colm McCann, with only a fairly vague sense of Nureyev's story. I knew he had defected from the Soviet Union. I knew he was gay. But that was really about it. McCann's book, which is both classical and experimental, it seems to me, was a revelation. Just so incredibly immersive, filled with the voices of the people who knew Nureyev best. It's really one of the greatest feats of sort of literary resurrection that I can think of. I really felt that I was in the presence of Nureyev. When did you first come across this book?
It's almost like a ventriloquist's act, isn't it? Because each chapter is told from a different character's point of view. I think I just read a review about it and became fascinated initially. When I was growing up in Mexico, my mother, who is Hungarian and had trained as a dancer, used to take me to Fontaine and Nureyev films in the cinema. So that was my introduction to Nureyev, and I think I became fascinated by their partnership and by him, because he was utterly mesmeric. So I was intrigued by the reviews of this book and utterly, utterly compelled by it. I think I read it very, very quickly, and in fact immediately thought that it could potentially be a film, and suggested this to my principal screenwriter, Olivia Hetreid, who was very intrigued as well and very much up for it. I then tracked Colin McCann down, who lives in New York, and tried to persuade him to option his book to me. And we got along extremely well. There was a real connection between us, and I absolutely adored him. But he had a slightly more glamorous offer, I think, from someone else in Hollywood, and decided to go with that. Nevertheless, I didn't really abandon the dream of making a film about Nureyev. And what has ended up happening is that Olivia Hetreid wrote a wonderful screenplay about the partnership between Fontaine and Nureyev. And although Ralph Fiennes made a film called The White Crow, which covers his early childhood right up to the defection, the script that Olivia has written essentially is the next chapter in the story. So this is a project that I very much hope to be my next film. And therefore, I really do have to attribute this to having read Colm's book, Dancer, as the initial inspiration to tell this story.
We start off in this book in the sort of depths of the Second World War in a sort of makeshift field hospital somewhere in the vastness of the Soviet Union, and a young Nureyev dancing for the wounded soldiers. It's a very potent image. What the book presents is someone who is an absolute force of life, both as a dancer, but also, of course, as a lover. The book suggests that there could have been no other answer for him but to defect, because he couldn't have lived the life he wanted to live in the sort of totalitarian world of the Soviet Union. Was that your impression?
Yes, and I also think that what really comes across in the book is an extraordinary voraciousness on his part to eat life and to absorb as much as he could about absolutely everything, whether it was art in a museum, or poetry, or novels, or theater, or dance, or indeed sex. You know, there was a voraciousness about him. And he started quite late as a dancer. He didn't really start training properly until he was, I think, 17, which is incredibly late for a dancer.
I think his father was pretty adamant that this was not the course that he wanted his son to take.
Yes.
This was not a manly
yes.
course in life.
And ironically, he was the first male dancer to really appeal to other men and who did not in any way seem fey or effeminate, had a great virility about him, both in terms of how he danced and how he came across on stage. And men felt comfortable with this vision of a male dancer, as well as women swooning over him because he was extremely beautiful. But I think it was that sense of being in a hurry that really comes across so well in Colm's book. And he didn't live that long. I think he died at 54 of AIDS in the end. But he packed a lot in to those 54 years.
One of the many characters that takes turns in narrating the story of Nureyev is a character called Yulia. She's the daughter of Nureyev's first teacher, and she lives in Leningrad. And Nureyev is sent to Leningrad as a 17-year-old to stay with her. She leads quite a tragic life through the arc of this novel. She marries someone that she later divorces, who's pretty brutal to her. And her artistic and life ambitions are generally thwarted by the oppressiveness of the Soviet Union. We don't know that when she first meets Nureyev. And this is a short clip of that meeting when she's waiting at Leningrad train station for the arrival of the young prodigy. It's read by Dion Graham and is part of the Random House audiobook.
The railway platforms were wet from the passengers' shoes and their shaken umbrellas. The whole day seemed weighted under a subdued gray damp. Railway workers moved around in their dark boredom. A new symphony was being piped through the loudspeakers, some factory drill of cello and violin. I took a bench under the platform eaves and watched as a woman my age bid goodbye to two teenage children. I smoothed my dress, neither too solemn nor celebratory, trying all the time to imagine what he would look like. My mother had sent me a photograph taken years before, while she was still teaching him in Ufa. He had the thin, cheeky face of a peasant boy, high Tatar cheekbones, sandy hair, a cocked stare. But he was 17 now and would surely look different. She said he was extraordinary, and I would recognize him immediately. He would stand out from the crowd. He had even turned walking into a sort of art. When the train finally arrived, pouring steam into the air, I stood and held out a hat that had once belonged to my father, a prearranged signal. It was patently absurd, but I felt a vague thrill, waiting for a boy half my age to emerge out of the day. I scanned the crowd, but nobody matched his description. Walking through, I brushed against summer overcoats and suitcases, even went so far as to hail two young boys who, in their fear, thought I was an official and hurriedly showed me their papers. The next train was not for another 4 hours, so I went out into a light rain. In front of the station, someone had altered the face of Stalin, chipping out tiny, almost imperceptible pox in the stone cheeks. The flowers beneath the statue had gone untended. The statue's defacement was foolish, of course, if not outright dangerous, but it was shortly before the 56th Congress, and we could already feel the thaw in Leningrad. It was as if a tiny crack had opened and light was spilling through, a cumulative light that would continue to spread, its existence becoming an undeniable fact of our lives. Black canvas tents stood over the tram tracks where they were being repaired. The price of radios had fallen. Shipments of oranges from Morocco were getting through. We hadn't seen oranges in years. Buyers pushed at one another down by the Nivaz docks. Just a few months before, in an attempt to resuscitate desire, I had been able to buy my husband 8 bottles of his favorite Georgian wine. We even had hot water piped into the apartment, and very late one night I had slipped into the bath with him, surprising myself, him even more so. For a while, Iosif had brightened considerably, but when he finished the wine, he revisited his policy of gloom. Instead of waiting outside the station, I walked along the Neva, past the prison, down to the bridge, where I took a tram to the university. I rapped on my husband's door to inform him of the situation, but he wasn't in his office, probably working somewhere or dallying with one of the other physics professors. It was my first visit back to the university in quite a while, and there was a hollowness to the corridors as if I were walking through the belly of a drum that once formed the musical centerpiece of my life. I even toyed with the idea of going into the linguistics department, but I felt that it might rekindle old wounds, not salve them. Instead, I dug an old pass out of the depths of my bag and put my finger over the expiration date so I could get into the canteen. The food was grimier and more insipid than I remembered. The ladies behind the counter regarded me with a sort of disdain, and a man with a giant broom pushed bits of food and rubbish around the floor, moving slowly as if contemplating the deep mysteries of his sloth. Feeling like an intruder into my former life, I left. Outside, the sun had broken through the clouds, and reefs of Arctic light lay on the sky.
You're listening to Shelf Life. I'm talking with Anthony Fabian about two of his favorite books. One of the striking thoughts as I was reading this is that were it not for the AIDS epidemic, the AIDS pandemic, would be around now in his 80s, most likely. And that really sort of filled me with just a sense of all the loss that occurred in the 80s and 90s in particular, that he was so young and still had so much to give. I mean, when he came to the West. Margot Fonteyn was well past dancing age, and yet they created this incredible union. I think they danced together for something like 2 decades. She was dancing into her 60s. And Nureyev was a young man when he met her, and she was in her 40s. He also changed attitudes in his relationship with Margot Fonteyn, especially to dance, that you could continue to dance, classically dance, into, you know, middle age and beyond.
Yeah, absolutely. And what I want to focus on in telling their story is a very brief period from the time they met until their triumph, dancing Macmillan's Romeo and Juliet, which they unfortunately had to steal from two younger dancers that Macmillan had been choreographing this ballet for. And I think what happened was that, for me, it is really a love story, an unconventional love story, because they ended up being much greater support for each other than their principal relationships, their sexual relationships were. Intimacy was physical because dance is so physical. It's just absolutely unavoidable. But it was very much emotional as well. And Nureyev, having defected, had no family in the UK. And Margot became like a mother, a sister, a lover to him. And she also undoubtedly fell in love with him. And love has this extraordinary power and energy about it. So I think that her ability to dance for another 20 years was not only driven by the fact that her husband became a paraplegic and she needed to continue to dance to pay for his care, but she was given that energy by the love that she felt for him. And I think that's a very, very powerful story.
Yeah, there's a lovely scene. I took a note of it at the time, but I just thought it was so tender that really captured that relationship. Margot Fonteyn takes Nureyev to her home at the Panamanian embassy. She's married to a Panamanian official, and makes him a lamb stew. And she laughs when he pulls his shirt over his head and he inhales the lamb stew she makes. And she jokes that she is the mutton and he is the lamb. And I just loved that camaraderie, that intimacy between them.
Yeah.
It wasn't sexual, but was deeply compassionate.
Yes. And Colm is just a genius because he's managed to turn a quote from her. She said, you know, when it was suggested that she might dance with him for the first time, that it would be like mutton dancing with lamb. And he manages to take that quote and reuse it in this very intimate domestic scene. But as I say, he also is a ventriloquist because he takes on the voice of so many different people. And I just adored the sheer brilliance, technical brilliance of the book, as well as the story.
Nureyev himself is scatological, foul-mouthed, given to sexual braggadocio. Although I think I'd enjoy a night in his debauched company, I wasn't sure I'd like him as a person. Did you relate to him in any way?
I think so, because there's always a vulnerability about him. And he's highly intelligent. If you see, there's a wonderful interview that you can find still on YouTube with Dick Cavett, who I think interviewed him once or twice, and talk about cats. He sits there on the sofa, very cat-like, in these very long leather boots, and has this enigmatic expression on his face. And he somehow manages to remain very dignified, but at the same time, very naughty. And I think I would have liked him, actually. I think I would have found him utterly charming. Everyone who met him certainly fell under his spell. And I think a lot of that other element, the rougher element, the demanding, the diva element of him was really about having very high standards and wanting to be the absolute best and wanting everything around him to reach those standards and not accept mediocrity in any way, shape or form. And anyone who makes films and is trying to achieve something great will understand that.
You're listening to Shelf Life. I'm Aaron Hicklin, and my guest today is the director, Anthony Fabian. We're talking about the book Dancer by the Irish writer Colm McCann. a figure that haunts Nureyev's life, Tony, is his mother. Once he defects, he cannot see her again. He's tried in absentia and will not be able to return without being sent essentially to the gulags. He spends much of his life trying to get her out of the USSR. He is able to go back late in his life to see her. And there's a very poignant scene where he's not at all sure that she even recognizes him. I found that unbearably moving.
Completely agree. I don't think I can add anything to that. I mean, what he risked in leaving was truly enormous, because one of the techniques that the Soviets used to keep people there was to make the lives of their families absolutely miserable if they defected. And so he was not only risking his own life through this defection, and there is documentation that suggested that Khrushchev literally wanted his legs broken after his defection to stop him from dancing. But he certainly made the lives of his mother and his family extremely difficult. And he knew that that would be the case, as well as punishing him by not allowing any contact between him and his family once he left. So it was a very brutal system and remains a very brutal system today.
I found, whether McCann intended it or not, this novel to be a pretty devastating critique of Soviet repression. At the beginning, the family are worrying about the beet harvest and whether they're going to have enough to eat. And at the end, you know, when we're in the 80s, they're still worrying about the same things. And meanwhile, we have this fabulous life that Nureyev has sort of been able to create for himself. Everybody who's anybody is in his presence, from, you know, Warhol to Kennedy to Rock Hudson. But all these characters really put Nureyev at the heart of the American cultural century.
Yeah, no, it's extremely rich and complex. And Nureyev's biography hugely praised McCann for the truth that he managed to arrive at through this fictionalized account of Nureyev.
Can we separate Nureyev's sexual energy from his creative energy, do you think? McCann certainly seems to present him as obsessively horny.
Yeah, no, I think that those two energies were aligned and related. Obviously, dancing didn't exhaust him enough to stop him from having lots of sex. Yeah, it was very well documented again that he had a voracious sexual appetite.
You mentioned that your mother was a dancer. You worked in opera for a long time. You must have been very familiar with the world that is described in this book. How does that affect or impact your experience reading it?
I'm very interested in art forms that combine other art forms. And opera is certainly one of the most complete art forms, because you have music, you have theater, you have performance, you have dance. You have singing and, of course, orchestral playing. So there are many, many different art forms that are combined in the creation of opera. And ballet is not dissimilar, minus the singing, of course, and minus the words. But it's a world that I certainly felt very at home in, and that I want to continue to delve into in terms of my filmmaking. So Mrs. Harris, I've often described as a musical without the singing, certainly in terms of my approach to the choreography of the camera and some of the choices that I made in terms of how a scene would play out. I had very much either Umbrellas of Cherbourg or Funny Face in mind. There's a cabaret scene within Mrs. Harris that I studied Bob Fosse's film Cabaret for quite closely, to explore different angles that I thought might be interesting. And in hoping to make a film about the partnership between Margot Fonteyn and Rudolf Nureyev, I'm also going to be creating this Wagnerian idea of a Gesamtkunstwerk, you know, a complete work of art where everything is included.
As a director, what movies have you seen that you would say managed to capture the kind of world of dance as completely as you would like to in your next project?
The films that I have been inspired by, All That Jazz, for example, again, a Fosse masterpiece, which I think is definitely due a reappraisal. Cabaret, I think, also is a very, very great film by Fosse. But the other inspiration for this is a film by Carlos Saura, who was the great flamenco dance director. And he made a film based on Bizet's Carmen, in which there is an offstage story and an onstage story that are directly in parallel to each other. And it often segues from the offstage story into the onstage story. And the director choreographer who's putting on a flamenco dance version of Carmen has trouble finding his Carmen. Then he finds her, then he falls in love with her. He has an affair with her. And the onstage relationship between Don José and Carmen is echoed by the offstage relationship between this director choreographer and the glorious Laura del Sol, who plays Carmen. So that's, I think, one of the greatest dance films ever made. And it's incredibly thrilling. When making Margot Fonteyn and Rudolf Nureyev's story, I really want to take advantage of the kinetic energy of dance and how much energy that can give to the editing. And, you know, for me, it's like, it's as exciting as watching a great sports event. And I think it's ridiculous to limit the idea of ballet to an elite audience when actually sport is one of the most popular things that anybody ever watches.
Anthony, you've mentioned a couple of times growing up in Mexico City. I wonder if you can elaborate.
When I was 3 years old, my father got a job with a company called Syntex, which manufactured the contraceptive pill. And so he was going to help develop the mini pill, the progesterone pill. And so my older brother, my mother and my father and I all moved to the center of Mexico. And growing up in Mexico was an extraordinary experience, which I think is almost best encapsulated by the extraordinary film by Cuarón, Roma. That was exactly the period that I was there. And it was incredibly reminiscent for me of my own experience of living there. And what I think you become intensely aware of when you grow up in Mexico is this tremendous disparity of class. Obviously, that was translated and augmented by living in the UK, but certainly planted in Mexico City, where you had to almost wear blinkers to all the poverty that you saw around you, and where essentially you were living in a world that was both a first world and a third world simultaneously. But it was an incredibly rich, colorful, vibrant, beautiful culture to grow up in. And I regret that I haven't had an opportunity to spend much time in Mexico since.
Anthony Fabian, thank you so much for being my guest today. It's been a real pleasure to talk about one of my childhood favorite books, as well as this new discovery, thanks to you, of Dancer by Colin McCann. Thank you.
It's been my great pleasure too. And it's actually quite cruel to limit a discussion to only two books, but that is the nature of the beast, isn't it?
We've been talking about Dancer by Colin McCann, published by Metropolitan Books, and The Abandoned, aka Jenny, by Paul Gallico, published by the New York Review of Books. Mrs. Harris Goes to Paris is in theaters now. My thanks, as always, to my producer, Ilya Maritz, and sound engineer and composer, Tim Wood. Shelf Life is a production of Grand Journal, and if you like the show, you can find past episodes on Apple and Spotify with guests such as Alan Cumming, John Waters, Joyce Maynard, Sir David Hare. If you like what you hear, help us get noticed by giving us a 5-star rating.
This is Radio Catskill. There's a winter storm warning for our listening area from 1 this afternoon through 7 tomorrow evening. Heavy snow will start moving into our area late this afternoon. 8 to 16 inches is possible. More in high elevations in areas to the east, less in Delaware and northern Wayne counties. New York State's declared a state of emergency in Sullivan, Ulster, and Orange counties, among others. State officials urge residents to stay home throughout the duration of the storm. This is Radio Catskill.
Ankusa Grace, KG, doing African-American history during the month of February. Black History Month was originally created to fight ignorance and to prevent the continuation of misconception about black people and their history. So I'll be doing presentations on black history from then until now. So please check me out Tuesday on The Music Emporium.
Support for